Hey, good morning. Chris Roberts back here on the Commissioner's Corner on Unforgettable 1220 in the new 104.3 WERT and Classic Hits 99.7, which is WKSD. Good to have you along here. Yeah, we were off for a week, and everybody's back in here today. This is like old home week. We're all getting back together again. Our three Van Wert County Commissioners, Thad Lichtensteiger and Stan Owens and Todd Wolfram with us as well. And special guest in the studio here this morning is John Vining, who is a local author, writer, and we're going to have a good time here today. John brought those books, and I know the assignment was to read these books before the show here today so we can discuss these things. And this is really interesting stuff. But we'll start off the top here this morning with the county. It's been a couple of weeks since we've been on the air. Anything we need to talk about here this morning?
Well, there was a takeover of power at our office.
Yeah, right? Coup.
A bloodless coup.
Stan took over the chairmanship from me, but we just kind of rotate that every year.
And, gotcha.
Yeah.
So it's not a big deal.
But Stan rules with an iron fist, so we're going to have to fall in line.
The first thing he announced was a huge tax cut in time for next Christmas.
Yeah, there you go. On the right line.
Yeah, really. Okay, good. It was interesting, though. The other day, I know a lot of the media that doesn't like to report much about what's going on in Washington in a positive way actually did let a few stories get through, like Apple was going to bring $250 billion back into the United States again. That's got to make a dent in something, you know.
Cut that corporate tax rate and all sorts of good things are going to happen.
Well, in that case, you know, and it's not politics. You know, that is not politics. That is strictly business. It's the cash is what it is. It's, you know, how much can we save versus how much do we have to give away? And they don't care if Mickey Mouse was the president. When those tax numbers make sense, they make sense. That money goes where the taxes are lower, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting to see anyway. Speaking of taxes. So that's basically about it. You know, we've had a nice, quiet 2018 so far then, I guess, huh?
Well, and we had a conversation with Senator McCauley on the phone, but he's going to be on, Thad says, maybe next week or the week after. So
right.
About some wind turbine issues, legislation, things of that nature. But we'll wait for him to come on to explain that.
Good. Okay. The wind turbine thing's a complex issue.
Yeah, it is.
Getting more complex by the minute, isn't it? All right. Well, let's talk with John then. John, local writer here, John Vining, and John brought some books with us. And you write about a lot of different things, not the least of which is Native Americans.
Yes, I really enjoy that. You know, we live in an area that was once dominated by Native Americans, and we have a little bit of a misconception about how we acquired this land. We basically took it. And so one of my missions is to bring awareness to the fact that, you know, we owe quite a debt mm-hmm. to the local Native Americans.
Is this, where did the Trail of Tears that we hear about so often, where did that start at? Was that in this area?
Well, there were several Trails of Tears. The one that we think most about is the Cherokee Nation from the Georgia and Alabama area mm-hmm. to Oklahoma. But we had a local one. Fort Shawnee over here was a fort where Indians were detained, and they were moved to Oklahoma and Kansas as well in the 1830s. So there were several, and they were very sad. Very sad.
The Native Americans in this part of the country seemed to go along with it. By the time the whole idea reached out west, it started to get violent at that point, did it not?
Yes. There was a violent period here from 1790 to 1818 with the settlement of the Treaty of St. Mary's after the War of 1812. It was much less violent here mm-hmm. after that point in time. And
I guess back in the days of Hardin's defeat, that would have been one indication right there of the violence. Would
yes,
it not?
Hardin's defeat was mm-hmm. was quite a thing. The whole Harmer's whole campaign was very bloody and mm-hmm. Very violent. So, yeah, there was a lot of violence in this area. It was basically the making of an empire.
How'd you get interested in writing about Native Americans?
A very interesting story about that. I've always been interested in writing, and I was heading for Indianapolis one day, and I saw the Battle of Mississinewa on the map on the way. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I'll just make a quick trip past there and take a look at that battle site. And here it was a cavalry raid in the War of 1812. And I just threw up my hands and said, what? And so I came back and I started doing some research on Fort Recovery, on Fort Jennings, Old Fort, Fort Meigs. And I found that there was a whole area, you know, a whole area of history that was kind of underreported.
And in those days, the War of 1812, the Indians were fighting on the side of the British.
That's true. That's true. The British allied, they had several things they wanted to do. They wanted to maintain their fur trade in this mm-hmm. area. They also, in my opinion, wanted to destabilize this area. This area was given to Revolutionary War veterans as payment for mm-hmm. their service. And if the British could destabilize this area and make those people unhappy, they may reconquer this area. And
I'm sure they also, of course, realize the great value of the Great Lakes, and that's one of the reasons the Commodore Perry victory was so tide-turning in that war, was that it basically shut down what was going to be very useful for the British.
Were the Indians allied with the French at some time, some point?
Further back in history, yeah, a little more back before this time they were, but of course the French lost most of their North American empire in the 1760s to 80s.
And the Indians, I should say the British were so well organized in those days, they were able to convince almost anybody that they were going to be the winners. You know, they had the uniforms, they were fighting with the traditional methods, and we were just basically a bunch of insurgents that didn't look like we could win anything, although we kept on winning.
And they had the empire on which the sun never set, right?
They were the dominant power in the world, as much as we are today. And you want to be on the side of a winner if you want to pick an ally.
Yeah. And not only Native Americans do you write about, but you also write about other histories as well.
I do. I've read a lot. I've been studying this stuff for over 50 years. My father got me books back when I was like 11 years old.
So you loved history as a kid, which probably does not describe the rest of the people in this room, me included.
Well,
I mean, this whole history thing for me is about 20 years old.
Grew up in the 60s and 70s, and to be a military historian at that time was not the most popular thing, so I read about it, but I kind of read about it on the side.
Then you probably don't know my wife. She's not a big fan, as were a lot of people not big fans, as you pointed out, of military action back in those days.
At some time when I was reading about this, I'd read that the United States had never been invaded successfully. There were a few raids, but I began to think, as a manager, which is my vocation, mm-hmm. I began to think, well, how could you do that? And I thought, well, you know what could have happened? Was that the Germans, when they sent the Zimmerman telegram to Mexico during World War I to start another front, mm-hmm. what if the Mexican just said, well, let's just wait till the Americans are over in Europe with their army and are on the...
Weakened, yeah.
Yeah.
See, and an opportunity.
Maybe we could take Texas and New Mexico back again, because what happens to be in West Texas would be really valuable.
You know why? Because George Patton was over in Europe at that point. He's the guy who had success in Mexico.
Right,
you know,
exactly. So, yeah. And Pershing as well.
Sure.
So they were all gone. So I did write a book, a historical novel, and yeah, they decided, yeah, we might just be able to carve out a state and capture that oil again in West Texas.
Wow. And in those days, were they looking at Texas as being an oil state?
They more looked at it as their lost northern empire.
Gotcha.
And, of course, everybody from Santa Ana on
sure.
has said, we want to recapture our northern empire again. And, of course, they had some posers as presidents and generals who could make some points with the populace by saying, yeah, we're going to capture it. Well, what if they actually tried it?
Yeah, I'm sure it fascinates you to realize some of the decisions that were made in those days and why they were made. Some of them made great sense, and others were just literally pulled out of thin air.
Yeah, there was. Our history is full of what could have happened, you know, if a different decision was made. And that's probably David McCullough's made that point before, a very famous historian. History didn't have to happen like it did. Decisions made a difference.
One of my favorite what could have happened happened, I think, during the War of 1812, and it may have been 1813 by this time, or maybe not, but Washington, D.C., where the British were about ready to take Washington, and the tornado showed up and scared them off. They didn't know what was
really?
Going on. Yeah, they had never seen a tornado before.
Don't have tornadoes in Great Britain.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's...
I mean, they were literally coming on into town. They were going to take it.
There's some weird things that happened in history. In East Africa one time, the British were invading this port, and they hit a bunch of bumblebees, and the bumblebees stopped the offensive.
Is that right?
Yeah, they actually had to get back on their ships. So weird things happen.
You know, when we see war movies and things like that, we think that that war happens quickly. It's actually a very, very long, drawn-out, laborious process that has moments of terror and weeks and months sometimes of extreme boredom. Am I right?
That's true. Up until recently, one of the things that has made the United States very, very successful is our mobility.
Mm-hmm. These days, things are different.
Well,
sure.
Even up to World War II, people don't realize that the decision to invade Guadalcanal was made around the 4th of July, and they invaded several thousand miles away. They put their ships together, they put mm-hmm. everything together, and actually invaded in about 5 weeks.
Is that right?
So, they brought the stuff from the West Coast.
But it's not like in the movies, you know, where like, all right, next week we're going to do that. No, you're not. You know?
Yeah.
When you move an army, you move literally a continent along with it. All the support, all the fuel, all the people, the cooks, the food, not only the things that we think about that traditionally are used for prosecuting a war.
But Napoleon said a army travels on its belly, which mm-hmm. means the logistics are important. And logistics were a problem for a long, long time.
Do you see in your writings and in your study of history, do you see where the Napoleonic types of thought processes echoed through other chiefs and people who did make decisions as far as the war is concerned?
Napoleon was a titan among generals. Every general studied him in the Civil War. I mean, everybody had studied Napoleon. Now, there are two schools of thought. There's the Jomenian school of thought and the Clausewitz school of thought, but everybody studied him. And, you know, when the North was following the Jomenians, they were losing. When they started winning battles, as Clausewitz said, they won the war.
I saw a discussion one time on, I think it was on C-SPAN, it was coming from the Smithsonian. There were two scholars on there. One was saying that Napoleon was the first to realize the value of flanking armies. And the other guy was saying, no, it was actually Alexander the Great who realized the value of flanking armies.
Alexander was brilliant. He is actually the first, but Napoleon was just brilliant. You know, he never had a numerical advantage. He always fought against a consortium of countries, and he very, very, very rarely lost. Russia was a...
Yeah, and that's one of the more interesting stories in history, how Russia beat him by just evacuating Moscow. Everything in his path, they just evacuated. And basically starved his army.
A second little corporal tried that in 1941 and 42, and he wasn't much more successful either.
Russia knows just how to disappear and let you starve.
Scorched earth. They just pulled back and let Mother Nature and Uncle Mud defeat him.
Yep. What do you make of the winter at Valley Forge? I mean, it's even worse than most people can even comprehend.
I don't think, perhaps maybe here in the Midwest and the northern climes, we get a feel for it, but I don't think generally people realize the sacrifice that these soldiers made. They weren't getting paid very often.
That's the whole point, yeah. There was,
they didn't have
not
shoes.
Only were they getting paid, they didn't have any clothes or food, and they're still there hanging in there.
And nobody thought they could win.
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
on
and,
top of that.
And
they were going to get hung as traitors, you know, the generals if they lost.
It's like the Cleveland Browns times 100.
The Browns camping out on the lake.
I really don't know if Valley Forge was that bad.
Not that bad. Huh?
But no, it was a very, very... Washington's main value is that he kept the army together and kept an army in being through two horrendous winters. Mm-hmm. The winter at Monmouth, New Jersey was nearly as bad. And so he would just go through, and these people had no boots on. They're leaving blood in the snow as they were walking from their hut.
Interestingly enough, though, Washington wasn't there all the time to rally these people. He would leave, go out, try to get support and more people and food and things that they needed, and then come back and have to pump them all back up again.
He had to go fight with his Continental Congress all the time for support. These guys were saying, well, maybe we better protect our own skin and get out of here. Mm-hmm. I said, well, you got an army out here that's starving.
Yeah, because they had farms at home. Of course, they weren't going to do anything in the wintertime, but they had responsibilities and families elsewhere.
And I think they're more concerned sometimes about their neck, you know, because, yeah. Like you said, that they were going to be hung as traitors if they lost, and Washington realized that, and still he hung in there, and the men not being paid and freezing to death hung in there.
Do you think that really it was an insurgency? I mean, you couldn't tell the fighters from the non-fighters. It was a little bit like, you know, the North Vietnamese in that case, the regulars, you know, they all had a green clothes on. But you know, when you talked about the Viet Cong, they showed up in whatever they had, and very difficult to fight an insurgency. And I wonder if even today, the terrorists, you know, take a page out of our history and the way we fought as a ragtag army. We could hit and run almost anywhere without announcement, and that's what they do.
Particularly in the South, after the defeat at Camden, really the only soldiers left were insurgents under Francis Marion and Thomas Sumter. And yes, they are kind of the father of this insurgent, you know, where they lived off the land, they faded back into the populace. They had these enclaves way back in the swamps, and they would come out, and they would strike, and they would strike the logistics, which is the key to winning,
sure.
And they would destroy all these supplies, and then they'd pull back. So yes, the Vietnamese, if they were, well, we know that they were very intelligent, they took a page out of our history.
The war of attrition is always the most difficult way to win a war. I mean, the logistics and cutting off the supplies and making it impossible to fight is how you bring people to the bargaining table generally.
You can't fight if you don't have bullets and food.
Sure, yeah.
And that's where you win.
So, and also fascinating, you know, people like the so-called outlaws of the 1800s, the Billy the Kids and people like that, they wound up being, a lot of those guys were insurgents for the South, were they not, for the Confederate Army?
Particularly Frank and Jesse James were allied with Quantrill's Raiders, very famous, infamous, I guess is the term.
So they were used to killing before they went on their bank robberies, you know, sprees.
These were not Robin Hood type of people. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They were cold-blooded killers, and they were tough people, and they were mad about losing, and they were mad about how they lost. The North did some bad things in Missouri where they came from as far as devastating an area to keep supplies from these people.
So a lot of us take Avengers and make folk heroes out of them.
Yeah. You
know, that's really what it was.
They had something to prove, and they proved it, and they were tough guys.
So, John Vining, tell me about the books that you brought here today. You've got some of your work here.
I have four books that I have out there, the Trans-Appalachian Wars we've been discussing about the military conquest of the area between the Appalachian Mountains and the Mississippi River between 1790 and 1818. Interesting story behind that we may have time to get to. But I also wrote a compendium that I don't have with me of short stories I had written for over 50 years, and some of them were my brother's and some of them were mine. I also wrote Cable of Fate that we talked about possibly a fictitious invasion of the Southwest, and also wrote a book called Peace in the Valley, in which my brother actually wrote the manuscript for this, and he passed away. And I found it in a bunch of stuff that he just left.
Really?
You know, there was a bunch of staplers and VCR tapes, and I dug down through this, and I found this manuscript. And I thought, man, this is really good. It's rough, but I think I can rewrite this, and I think it'll be good. And so I kind of took that on. And it's a story of Civil War sharpshooter who marries a Quaker lady. They start to live, and then she feels a call to be a missionary to the rural Lakota, the Sioux, in western Nebraska and the Dakotas. And this guy is kind of a guy, kind of like a little big man, Jack Crabb type of guy that just observes all this stuff from a viewpoint as he goes through history.
See, normally in television, we hold up the book and we say, this is what it looks like, folks. You can't do that here on radio. So how do we get your books?
I have a website. I'll be a shameless plug here.
Absolutely. For my, please
right?
do.
It's www.johnericvining.com.
That's common spelling, V-I-N-I-N-G. Uh-huh.
J-O-H-N-E-R-I-C-V-I-N-I-N-G.com. And it's just all together. And you can go there. You can read a little bit about me, a little bit about the books, some of the things I think about the books, some reviews. And then you can also go there to a spot and click on Amazon or anything.
I was going to say, I did a little shopping the other day, and I saw that your books were on Amazon.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's pretty cool. That really is. It's you can't replace a book. And I know I'm asking a writer now, you know, a Kindle comes pretty close, but you can't replace a book.
I don't think so. I did pick the name John Eric Vining because if you just Google John Vining, you'll come up with a guy that committed some murders in Florida, so I wanted to use my middle name because I didn't want the guy to come up first when they were hunting for me online trying to buy my books.
That's a good call. That's a good call right there. Yep. All right. Well, now we'll remember John Eric Vining, ladies and gentlemen. He's the writer here with us today. Thanks for being here. I appreciate that.
Thanks a lot for having me. I really appreciate you guys, all the commissioners and you too, Chris, having me in.
Excellent conversation. Appreciate it. All right. There's John Eric Vining along with Thad Lichtensteiger and Todd Wolfram and Stan Owens, our three Vancouver County Commissioners. Hey, Chris Roberts here on the Commissioner's Corner.